a low point in the measurement of trust and confidence in the police. As of mid-July, almost 3 out of 4 Americans wanted to ban the use of stop and search in the United States. We have continuing controversies over the use of police powers, specifically stop and search, as well as tasers and others here in the UK, with a very low level of gun ownership in the population, which of course tends to shape the idea of over-policing, because over-policing in a context of very few people having guns might look very different from a context in which just about everybody's got guns. And I'll come back to the gun theme. But I think there's no doubt that the policing that we have been talking about in Hong Kong with my students over the past 4 years has a lot to do with the question of proportionality. And if we go right back to the common origins of English-speaking peoples in the common law of Britain, which was, after all, set up by an invading colonial power called the Normans, who themselves were an invading colonial power, even in France, when the Vikings came from the north. By 1361, they had started enacting statutes that survive and continue to influence the British lawmaking today, as well as some of the lawmaking in Hong Kong through the close ties to the British legal system and elsewhere. Possibly less so. But nonetheless, what we know from 1361 with the Magistrates Act, the creation of the powers and scope of authority and responsibility of the justices of the peace, is the first clear statement that there should be implicitly the use of discretion in deciding whether or not to invoke the law. This is, in its modern form, the prosecutorial principle that applies in the UK, not necessarily in the US, certainly not in some of the European traditions. But the basic principle is you have to pass two tests to prosecute in the UK. The first is that the law must have been broken, and the evidence about the breaking of the law must be very clear, but that's not sufficient as a reason to use the powers of the law, the powers of the police, to hold somebody legally accountable and punish them. It must pass the second test, and it's called the public interest test. Is it in the public interest to use the full powers of the police? And this question is a wonderful question for an empiricist, because it's an empirical question. And there are lots of ways we can find out whether it is in the public interest to arrest somebody for domestic abuse, which might look like a good idea if it reduces repeat offending in the next 6 months. It might look not so good if it increases repeat offending in the next 6 months. Some of you know that my research has shown both effects, depending on whether the offender is employed or unemployed. It's a very different question if you look 23 years out, as we did in Milwaukee, and we discovered that if the victim's abuser had been arrested by random assignment, the victim was twice as likely to be dead if she was African-American, as 75% of the victims were in that study. So if you make an arrest and it doubles the likelihood of a victim dying, is that in the public interest to be making those arrests? That is just one of many examples that I think need to be front and center in the teaching of criminology and criminal justice anywhere in the world, because criminology and criminal justice in most universities, primarily outside of the United States, I must say, criminology and criminal justice has grown out of a legal tradition in which it is a religious, non-empirically testable doctrine that punishment deters, and that it's the duty of the state to punish crime because that will prevent crime. But that is a testable hypothesis. And criminology has been growing in its relevance, growing in its influence by testing the proposition that punishment deters. And the more tests we conduct, the more we learn that the use of the legal sanction, and specifically arrest or things leading up to arrest by the police, is very much like the use of surgery in medicine, in that it's appropriate for some conditions and it's absolutely inappropriate for other conditions. Some of you may know a strange fact in the history of medicine is that one of the treatments for epilepsy used to be pulling teeth. There are other examples in which theoretically pointless operations were prescribed by surgeons because they could make money by doing an operation. And it's sort of something you do that people will give you money for because it's very visible. In terms of medicine, we're now very conscious of being minimally invasive in the curing of disease. And going back to 1361, the principle and empirical hypothesis of the legal system was proportionality, that you would not use something that is more harmful than the harm that you're trying to prevent. Again, continuity in the moral philosophy going back to Hippocrates, the Greek physician who founded what's called the Hippocratic Oath. He actually didn't prescribe people swearing to this oath, but his basic principle was first do no harm, which is not a clear statement. And what it really means is don't cause more harm by doing medicine than you are trying to prevent. The principle of proportionality is what Hippocrates gave us. And in recent years, even in a place like Camden, New Jersey, the police have been transformed by a principle of proportionality, of using what the chief who introduced it called Hippocratic policing. And this is not nearly as well established an idea in the US as it is in Britain, but the British constable has drummed into her or him from the very first day in what is now a bachelor's degree program in policing, that the police should act in a way that is proportionate. They may not even understand what that means, but they know that they're supposed to be proportionate. And so if we reflect on proportionality at a higher level, it seems to be central to the claims of over-policing in the United States, where 1,000 people a year are shot to death by the police with complete legal justification or at least impunity. Almost no police are ever prosecuted, and even fewer are convicted of a crime in shooting somebody to death. The Supreme Court of the United States actually doesn't care very much about proportionality. And as recently as 2018, they gave carte blanche, free hand to the police to shoot somebody who won't drop a knife when the police say they should, even if they're standing far away from anybody they could hurt with that knife. If the police order you to drop the knife and you don't, then you can die. Now, British law would say that's not proportionate, but America is not Britain, and all the countries in this Zoom call will have different legal standards about this. What you get with science is something that tends to be much more universal than legal principles. That is, you get empirical relationships. And the question of whether you should formally sanction a wife abuser in court in order to protect the abuse victim and to protect the community is something for which we may be building empirical science and finding out more things about what not to do in terms of managing the level of harm in the community through the commission of criminal acts. And so even broader than the question of how the police relate to promoting the rule of law and democracy, which is an issue that I'm going to be taking up in the next year with a major American institution that is looking at what is the role of the United States in terms of helping other countries to understand things that frankly aren't done all that well in the United States. We can look at the question of over and under policing in an empirical way. So that at the time, for example, in Hong Kong last year, we had very high levels of consensus in the survey data that the Hong Kong police were over-policing. We had a clear collapse in the public support for the police from literally May to August of 2019. And yet, what I don't think is recognized in anybody's discussions I've had in Hong Kong is that in that same time period, roughly 250 people were shot to death in the United States, and nobody was shot to death in the course of the protests in Hong Kong over that time period. Now, there's lots of things to be said about that, including the absence of guns in the general population in Hong Kong. But let's come back to the question of over and under policing. If we want to make a Chinese comparison via Hong Kong to what happened in the capital of the United States last week, what we would have in both cases of the capital being overrun by protesters and the Legislative Council in Hong Kong in July 2019 being overrun by protesters. What we have in both cases is a criticism that the police were under policing in relation to their defense of these temples of liberty, these temples of government, at least, regardless of the level of liberty. And what could be said about whether there is a level of harm done to something of symbolic importance, the place where laws are made, can actually be framed in a different way. And one way to frame it is that if it's property damage, it's not proportionate to kill people to prevent them from committing property damage. The statue of a very successful and wealthy slave trader in Bristol from the 18th century during the Black Lives Matter protests in Britain last June, the statue was pulled down by a crowd and pulled several meters across the street and dumped in Bristol Harbor. And the response of the cabinet member of the United Kingdom, who is responsible for policing and the security of the country, was to attack the police in Avon and Somerset, the constabulary serving Bristol, for under-policing. Her position was that the police should not have allowed that statue to be unlawfully removed from its pedestal and thrown into the harbor. Her reprimand of the Avon and Somerset police was met by an avalanche of protests from the professional, highly educated police leadership of the United Kingdom that said, you have no right to tell the police what to do. Under British law, you appropriate budgets, you can make policies, you can certainly write the laws. But the enforcement of the law since 1361 has been up to the discretion of the local police. And in recent years, the understanding and refinement of the concept of operational independence has developed because of a system put in place by the Home Secretary's own party, the Conservative Party of Britain, which in 2012 abolished the local committees that supervised the 43 police chief constables in England and Wales. It abolished those committees and made one elected official, the Police and Crime Commissioner, responsible for both setting the local taxes, which provide roughly 50% of the police budget, and in hiring and firing the chief constable. Firing for cause and not firing because the chief constable disobeyed a direct order of the Police and Crime Commissioner. I have two students in our master's degree program. Out of the 43 police and crime commissioners in England and Wales, two of them are my master's students. They have told me, they would tell you in this call, that if they tried to give a direct order to a chief constable of whether or not to try to stop a crowd from pulling a statue down, especially with three or four police officers and thousands of people who wanted to pull a statue down. If somebody could give an order to the chief constable, not just a cabinet minister, but the immediate supervisor, the elected official who is democratically accountable to the people for the conduct of the police force. If my police and crime commissioner students were told they should give a direct order to the chief constable, you know what they'd say? They would say, I cannot. As a matter of law, I am not allowed to give a direct order to a chief constable. And I am not the one who is responsible for proportionate policing. That is, under the rule of law, the duty and responsibility of the Crown's officer, and the Police and Crime Commissioner is not an officer of the Crown. They are an elected official. The chief constable swears an oath to the Crown, which is in effect to the rule of law itself, and to the empirical principle that in their best judgment, the public interest is best served either by not enforcing the law or by enforcing the law. The idea of under-policing versus over-policing being a judgment call of balancing the considerations, especially on the basis of proportionality. And I can tell you that the chief constable of Avon and Somerset would say about the statue being thrown in the water that the only way they could have stopped this would have been to attempt a police maneuver that would both injure police officers and injure members of the public. And for what harm to be prevented? Harm to a piece of stone that has stood there for 200 years. Now, somebody could make a case about the symbolic importance of a piece of stone. But I would argue that stones are stones and people are people. And we are an anthropocentric species. Humans come first. And I would not want, as a citizen of Bristol, if I was, which I'm not, although I am about to become a dual citizen of the United Kingdom, which I'm very pleased about, Bill. I'm just waiting for my ceremony, which can't happen until the COVID is over. But as a UK citizen to be, I would not want a cabinet member or a police and crime commissioner to be able to tell a chief constable what to do. In fact, even a chief constable cannot order a constable to make an arrest. They can suggest it. In effect, they can say, here's the plan. We're all going to go in and we're going to arrest these people. And the constable might say, sure. But if the constable had some good reason under the principle of proportionality that they shouldn't make an arrest because it was going to cause huge violence or even what happened in London in 1789 in the Gordon riots when the government made a decision to let Roman Catholics serve in the British Army in the 13 colonies in North America. And Lord Gordon, as a rabid anti-Catholic Protestant, made a speech inciting rebels to not only attack the government, but to burn down London, which they proceeded to do for a number of days before the Protestant British Army came in and shot to death 180 some Protestants who were protesting allowing Catholics to be appointed by the Crown to fight in the King's army at that time. What we have in Britain, I think, is a very high level of awareness of both proportional action in which the police should not risk maneuvers or operations of enforcement that could provoke death or serious injury either to members of the public or to the police, unless there is a risk of greater deaths or greater injuries if the police do not act. And that is a very clear principle that is much more helpful, I think, for making decisions than these endless rules about when you can and can't shoot that have been developed in some police departments. In 1985, the Tennessee v. Garner case in the US Supreme Court actually struck down a very clear rule, and at least until another decision came along to complicate it, basically said if somebody's running away from a property crime, you can't kill them as a way to apprehend them. And why? In 1985, in effect, the court said, Byron G. Whizzer, I can't remember his last name, the justice who wrote the opinion said, basically, you can't justify killing somebody for a property crime, because if you caught them and arrested them and prosecuted them, they probably wouldn't even go to prison. So why would you shoot them and take their life away? And it was an unjustified taking of life because of the imbalance, the disproportionality between that decision to kill and the harm that was going to be prevented by having somebody not escape justice for, well, in the case of Mr. Garner, stealing $15 from somebody's house in a burglary. And he was a very young man indeed at the time of his death by the hands of the Memphis Police Department. So under-policing and over-policing across the English-speaking world, including Nigeria's massive protests against the anti-robbery squad, the special anti-robbery squad called SARS, which had been killing people at whim and without accountability for some years. And so the government then abolished the SARS team and created a SWAT team, Special Weapons and Tactics, which is doing pretty much the same thing. It's very important to note the Nigerian case, if only because many of our students at Cambridge, many students in the United States, many white students, many places are convinced the fundamental problem is racism. But it's not racism in Nigeria, where all of the critics of the police and all of the police who are being criticized are all the same race. It's far deeper than racism when we talk about a fundamental philosophy of the use of force by government that depends on an empirical proposition that is testable through research. And that is that if the police take this action, is it going to make a community with a lower level of harm? It's a very rational utilitarian perspective as articulated by John Stuart Mill and before him, Jeremy Bentham, who was a mentor to Sir Robert Peel, who's right up here. Pantheon. This is actually a 19th century bust of Sir Robert Peel that a friend of mine saw on eBay, and he bought it for me. And I bought it off of him, and I often hold it at the table when our police leader students are doing their master's degrees, because Peel, not by his own words, but by his ghostwriter, who we think was a Cambridge graduate named Sir Richard Main, who served as the longest serving police commissioner of Scotland Yard, 39 years, Maine or somebody wrote the principle that the prevention of crime is the primary purpose of the police and not the visible efforts to punish crime. So this goes to the heart of the question of proportionality, the question of the public interest, the question of why do we have a police force? We don't have a police force to punish people. Punishment is not an end in itself. We have a police force to make a community safe against two things. And my predecessor, Sir Anthony Bottoms, would say, the first thing is riots, mob disorder, the threat to governance by the same forces that led to the beheading of King Louis XVI, that led to the attack on the Capitol last week, and potentially that you could say led to the rise of Adolf Hitler, which reminds us that 100 years ago in the Weimar Republic, the police were doing a remarkable job of living up to the 1361, 1361 Justice of the Peace Act, By doing what? They were stopping street fights, very large confrontations between the Communist Party and the Nazi Party. And in Munich, an incident for which Hitler was sent to prison, a police officer died trying to stop the mob of the Nazis and the mob of the Communists, creating disorder and threatening the stability of the state. We have in Berlin, in a wonderful book by a Chinese American historian who everybody in this room should know about, and his father had been Chiang Kai-shek's ambassador to the Weimar Republic in Berlin in the 1920s and 30s. And the son of that ambassador went to the United States, took a PhD in history at the University of California at Los Angeles, wrote a wonderful PhD dissertation, which I've read, and then published his book, The Berlin Police in the Weimar Republic, which is the story about the police fighting back the mob in order to maintain the legitimacy of the democratically elected government in Weimar, which was the capital of the Republic of Germany at that time, and doing a valiant job until, and this is of course very much an issue in relation to the Capitol Police last week and the accusation that they welcomed the Trump supporters with open arms. Come on here, let's pose for selfies. You wanna get to the Senate majority's lead? Senate office right over there. Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, one black officer is now credited as a hero for having distracted the crowd away from the unguarded Senate chamber where Mike Pence might have been kidnapped and hung, as many of the rioters were demanding. And thank you for the citation, Jan, so we can see the book about the Weimar police, the Berlin police in the Weimar Republic, and the contribution that that scholar made to our understanding that the police are meant to be in the middle. It may be something to complain about, and it may be the reason that everybody complains, but 2 weeks before the Capitol attack, there was a Proud Boys protest in Washington, and they were fighting with Antifa and others on the left. And a quote in the Washington Post from a Trump supporter was, "You now have both sides hating you, cops. Congratulations." And I read that and I immediately put it in something I was writing, because if you ask me if both sides of a divided country hate the police, then the police are doing their job. What is that job? The first thing that Peel wanted them to do, the first thing that citizens of Britain were demanding in the 1820s when Peel created the modern police in Britain as we know them. And that was to keep the streets orderly so you didn't have to worry about your house being burned down by the rioters. And so to keep public order as a general way to stop assaults that are unpunished, to stop property damage that is unlimited. And you know, massive parts of London did get burned down in the Gordon riots. That's the first thing. But the second thing is to deal with one-on-one relationships or small group relationships in a context in which people get drunk, they get angry, they fight, they use violence. And the point of the police is not to make sure that no crime goes unpunished, to always get your man. The point of the police is to minimize the amount of violence in that community by managing the interpersonal relationships, which is why it's been so important for me in doing experiments with arrest for domestic abuse to say, of course, domestic abuse is wrong, but that doesn't mean that punishment is right. That doesn't mean that you have won a victory when you lock up every wife beater in America. To which one of my English colleagues replied, as a victim's advocate, in effect, it doesn't matter if more women are victimized as long as we punish the victimization, because it sends the moral message that this kind of violence is wrong. And if you reread the statement, in effect, she's saying, we'll take a higher level of abuse of women in order to make our point. Well, that's all very well to say if you're not being abused. But I take the John Stuart Mill utilitarian perspective that if I'm supporting a policy that is causing more women to be victimized, then that's not a good thing. And I think we have Min Ji on the call from University of Maryland, my colleague, who has done a magnificent study of the effects of arrest versus simply having the police come to the home, according to the respondents to the National Crime Victimization Survey in the United States. And what Min Ji found with her co-author was that there's no difference in the rates of future victimization for domestic abuse between simply having the police come and then going on and having an arrest be made. It's not a randomized trial, but it's consistent with the idea that, yes, let's applaud Min Ji for her excellent contribution to this important question of proportionality. There is another philosophy, of course, of Kantian origins, a kind of principled insistence on doing the right thing regardless of the consequences. And that's reflected in the mandatory arrest policies, reflected in the demand for more arrests of police, reflected in the policy in Scotland Yard today, which is upheld if the offender is present, about 90% of the time they will make the arrests. And yet I just saw a preliminary study of a natural experiment in another police agency in England, in which across all of the officers who had the option to either leave the offender in the home to calm things down and then say, you should come to the police station next Monday morning and we'll work out what's to be done, versus putting the offender in a police car, sometimes over the protests of the victim, and having the offender be taken to a police station where they'll be held in custody for 3, 4, maybe 8 or 12 hours, and then go home very angry and upset. According to this natural experiment, in which officers who almost always arrested with cases that were haphazardly assigned to them, and officers who almost never arrested but used voluntary attendance at the police station on a subsequent date, the comparison is the closest thing we have to a controlled experiment in arresting wife abusers in the UK. And the comparison shows there's a much higher level of the crime harm index value after an arrest is made than after a voluntary attendance is made. Same kinds of cases, same kinds of people, same police agency, same kind of officers doing the same kind of work. And here is a case in which under-policing serves the public interest by reducing violence against women more effectively than full policing, as Theresa May, the former prime minister, who is all in favor of arresting everybody for everything. And since we couldn't do that, she wanted to expand it to something even bigger called coercive control, which is probably massively underenforced since it's much more difficult to see and prove. But I think the fundamental question begins with, what is our empirical evidence about the value of policing? And for every time I have cited empirical evidence in which over-policing backfires, under-policing works better, I have people who will tell me that evidence must be wrong, because they know that full enforcement of the law is always better than the police being, quote, lazy. Lazy at a time when one of our police forces doesn't even get a police car to show up after 4 days in one third of all of the cases where they say a police car is on its way. They can't even keep the promise of sending a police car, let alone processing all of the arrests, because the demand is too high. And that's leading us now into experiments in having people call the police and talk to a constable on a telephone or on a Zoom screen. And when they do that, the situation is resolved within 4 hours and the victims are more satisfied than if they are promised getting a police car. So some people would say it's under policing just to provide tele-policing and a consultation on video. We want full policing. So there's two empirical points. One is you don't have enough money for what you want, so it's not gonna happen. But secondly, even if you went to 50% of GDP and you did full enforcement, it would probably make things a lot worse. It would fill up the prisons. We'd go from about 80,000 people in prison to maybe 800,000 people in prison at a rate closer to the United States rate. The issue of under and over punishment in general is one that is far too often debated morally and philosophically, and not nearly enough of the criminological evidence is brought into that discussion. Legislators don't know about it, reporters don't know about it, judges don't know about it, and police don't know about it. Who has the opportunity to communicate what we know about sometimes sanctions work and sometimes they don't? I would put it to you, it's criminologists. And I would say that no matter where the members of this organization are teaching anywhere in the world, you would be able to make a difference by using criminology as the knowledge, as the empiricism that informs the ethical obligation that not everybody accepts, but I certainly would subscribe to, out of a Quaker tradition, much like the Quaker tradition that Paul Rock of the London School of Economics, who's with us today, has been descended from, because he has an ancestor who fought against slavery in the parliamentary debates in the 1790s, submitting evidence, including this including this terrible map. What is this map showing? It's the layout of a slave ship, and it shows how the slaves were arranged in 3 foot high spaces in the months that they took to get across the Atlantic. So ask me the toughest question of all. Was the Civil War in the United States worth it? To have 5% of the population die trying to put an end to the institution of slavery? Well, I go back and forth on this, but I have to say it can't be criticized to say that Lincoln did the wrong thing. Because if he hadn't gone ahead with a war, we might still have slavery. And so the disproportionality would have to be on the side of all of the slaves who died on the way across the Atlantic and all of the slaves who would suffer for years to come. And there's no precise mathematical models that will tell you much of anything about that. But it's the right question. Was the Civil War proportionate to the harm it was trying to prevent? I would say yes. So what about the Capitol? Was the Capitol Police incompetent or something deeper than that? In cahoots, or perhaps simply hoping that they would not have to deal with the severity of what was happening to them? I don't know the answer to that question. I think these are all good questions. But what I can say is that I've been studying police shooting people to death since the 1970s. And in the videos that you may have seen about the Capitol attack last week, there is a young woman who is part of a group that is breaking windows at the entrance to the speaker's lobby. These are sort of glass walls either side of the door. And over to the left of the window that this woman had just decided she could climb through, there was a man in a suit like mine with a gun pointing out. And a video recorded at the time said, "Gun, gun, gun, look out, look out." And this woman, who was an Air Force veteran, and incidentally, a convicted domestic abuser of her boyfriend's her husband's former girlfriend, she jumped through that window, and that National Capitol police officer in his suit and tie shot her to death right there. When I first saw that, I was thinking, was that appropriate? Then just yesterday, I found out that according to Liz Cheney, she said she was speaking in the House chamber in favor of the election result being confirmed from the Electoral College when she heard the shot ring out. And that means that the entire House of Representatives was in session and potentially vulnerable to this mob that wanted to come in and handcuff them because they had all those plastic handcuffs, or even do worse, like, you know, beat Nancy Pelosi to death. They had already beaten to death, eventual death of one of the Capitol Hill police officers. 56 Washington, D.C. police officers were to be hospitalized. This mob was murderous. And I would say that in relation to the harm that Ashley Babbitt, formerly of the American Air Force, the harm that she could have caused by not only coming in herself, but bringing 50 or 60 armed people behind her, armed with sticks, armed with flagpoles, doesn't matter. They could have killed a lot of members of the government. And so in that case, when we're talking about whether police in America should shoot people to death, one of the 1,000 a year, I would say, yes, I am glad that that Capitol police officer in his suit and tie shot Ashley Babbitt, because he stopped that mob from going through the breach at just the moment that backup officers were coming up in riot gear, right behind Ashley Babbitt to push out everybody who was there. Now, could they have shot them all? They could have. Could the Capitol Police, from the moment they were outnumbered, have shot the crowd in a way that would have deterred them from coming to the Capitol? Yes, they could have. But I think we have to compliment them for saying to themselves, or somehow organically deciding that they weren't going to shoot, by using the principles of proportionality. Because at that time, they didn't know what the mob was going to do when it got to the Capitol. They were thinly policing a perimeter, and they didn't shoot the people as they were approaching, as some people have said to me they should have done. What about the Legislative Council in Hong Kong? The police were in the building, but the Legislative Council wasn't. There was no threat to the safety of members of LegCo in Hong Kong in July of 2019. And at some point that day, somebody made a decision in the Hong Kong police to follow the principle of proportionality, which was to avoid injury to people in order to protect the property and premises of the Legislative Council. And the police disappeared without injury, and the mob came in and did horrible things to property, not unlike the horrible things that were done to the property of the Capitol building last year. And so in a funny way, I want to point out that the things we didn't like about it, certainly there were those in power in Hong Kong who didn't like the police leaving the LegCo rather than defending it. In both the Hong Kong case and the Capitol Hill case, what you saw was proportionality at work. The idea that under-policing was preferable to over-policing if there was a major risk of many lives being lost and the kind of bloodshed that could have ensued with different scenarios last week at the Capitol Hill confrontation is, I think, the stuff of many novels or movies. I think if somebody had proposed it as a plot 2 weeks ago, it wouldn't be believed, saying that just can't happen. But it did. 5 years ago, many would have said LegCo could not be invaded, but it was. We live in a time of very wide confidence intervals, speaking empirically, and a lot of things we couldn't imagine may well happen. But whether things are normal or abnormal, the principle of proportionality, of depriving people of no more liberty, inflicting no more harm than that which would be prevented by the intentional result of taking that action on behalf of the state. If we stick with that principle, then we are stuck with empiricism, and we depend heavily on criminologists to study the empirical question. Across many cases, can we find patterns in which under-policing works better to prevent harm than over-policing? As much of my life has been devoted to discovering, not with the belief that we should always under-police, but with a completely open mind to the cases in which over-policing, such as stop and search in high gun crime areas, is going to save lives as well. And so, as the British say, it's horses for courses. It's fitting the right solution or remedy to the right diagnosis. And the only way we can do that with crime and violence and disorder is to have more criminology and more empirical tests of hypotheses that law professors take for granted. And yes, lawyers and media and politicians will disregard criminologists with a quick judgment that I've heard even police chiefs say, I don't believe that. Yeah, thanks a lot. Let's just keep toiling away in our vineyards, keep piling up the knowledge of the effects of sanctions, the effects of policing, the effects of punishment under different conditions. And someday, as the world gets to be a better place, as I firmly believe it will, because of knowledge, someday that knowledge will be applied. It's getting applied more every day in British policing. And I have faith that the British police model will continue to inform police all over the world. And I hope this comment informs you in how you talk to your students about the relentlessly recurring policing issues in our globalized world of discourse. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Larry. For those of you who came in a little bit late, just to say that Larry has to go at 3, so the session will end at 3 o'clock rather than 3:15. Before I go to questions and before Larry goes, just to say that we're going to take a screenshot with Larry here right at the end of the question session. If anyone doesn't want to be in the screenshot, then obviously please leave beforehand. Louis is going to do a screenshot at the end of the Q&A session. We have 3 questions which have come in, one from Jean Hua, one from Peter, and one from Ivan, which I think are very